sure you're ready?
Yeah, I'm just gonna
ring
my tea.
Oh, so I'll hit record and then you're not ready.
Yeah, I'm ready now.
Okay, hello everybody, welcome to the Filmwork Podcast. We are now heading towards our last few episodes, this is the last four or five, and we've got a couple of guests coming back to the podcast to say goodbye, to help shove me out the door. So, welcome back, Danny Singer.
Yay!
Yeah, mate!
The Danny Singer Experience is back in the building. Get in.
You did promise on your last podcast that, yeah, I'm coming back.
And here I am.
You are true to your word. Yes, I invited Danny back because there was a film club, which is essentially what this is going to be, podcast, that we did plan to do a long time ago and never got around to. We said, come on, let's do that then. So we're going to do a double bill, which we'll get round to shortly. But first up, we're going to talk about another double bill that Danny's seen.
A passion project of mine.
That I haven't seen. as anyone that may recall way back in the, because you were mainly in the sort of first 100 episodes.
I was, yeah.
Or so, and you would quite often talk about Charlton Heston. Because you're a big fan.
Oh, Charlton Heston.
Yeah, Charlton Heston and the Planets of the Apes movies as well.
Of course,
And
yeah.
Are you up to date with those?
No, I haven't seen the remakes. The first one made me cry, I didn't watch the rest of them.
What, the first remake made you cry? Oh, well, the second one's more of an action movie. And it was good.
I might one
and
day.
And the third one is out this year called War for the Planet of the Apes. So they've made their own little trilogy with Andy Serkis as Caesar. But the second one was directed by, I think it's Matt, I was going to say Matt Ross, that's not right. Anyway, the guy that directed Cloverfield, I think. He's going on to direct the next Batman movie. But he did these last two Apes movies, but the second one, which was Dawn? No?
Rise, Dawn.
Rise came first, and then Dawn was second, because everyone went, that's wrong, shouldn't it be the other way around?
Oh yeah, that's true.
Yeah, and when you look at what the films are about, you'd be like, yeah, those titles are the wrong way around. Anyway, so you've got no comments on those, but they did. So Ben-Hur, you wanted to talk about on the podcast,
always
maybe a bit of Ten Commandments, and I just wasn't doing it. And I guess if you were around when Ridley Scott released Gods, and what the fuck was it, Gods and Men? Christian
Bale.
Yeah, I
didn't
watch
that. Right,
so the Ten Commandments remake, we could have done that. But you haven't, so there. But anyway, basically, I came away from that film going, three stars with Ben Pegley. It was it was okay, and it got accused of like whitewashing and all that nonsense.
Well, it was whitewashing. It's dreadful.
True, but it's a subject we don't like tackling here because you can never keep people happy. Because you can recast white roles with people of any other ethnicity, but you can't do it the other way around without fucking hell breaking loose.
That's probably a separate conversation, but we'll...
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 So, anyway, but you have seen the remake of Ben-Hur.
I have.
With up-and-coming star Jack Huston.
Is that what he is?
Do you remember when
star?
We saw Outlander?
No.
Outlander, you remember this? I'm pretty sure that you and I went to a Empire Comic-Con, and they had clips of... it's like a Viking set... thriller with Jim Caviezel who comes from outer space and there's a monster on his ship and they have to hunt down this monster.
Really vague memory.
Outlander it was called, and it was okay, it was fun. Jack Huston was like the young Viking sort of who's going to become king once John Hurt is dead kind of thing. Nice guy. That's how long ago he's been up and coming.
Yeah, I mean, I can see how that would be the case.
I think he had better success on TV.
He's pretty poor.
Oh dear.
Frankly. Shall I launch in?
Go on, Nan.
Right, so basically everyone listening at home, Ben-Hur is my favourite ever film ever. And even though I have a lot of films that are probably actually my favourite film, Ben-Hur's my spiritual favourite film.
Rocky IV.
Like Rocky IV, for example, is my actual favourite film.
And Rambo 2.
I thought it was like the anger and vengeance of Rambo caused him to explode. Oh, I'm sad now.
Oh, okay, good. So Ben-Hur's my...
Because he was that angry.
I still stand by that, so Ben-Hur's my favourite film because it raised me, I feel like. I used to watch it most weekends at my grandparents because it's, four and a half or whatever hours long. You just plonk it on and I was transfixed. So I've been watching it since the age of about four. So when I heard there was going to be a remake, I was very afraid, and justly so, because the remake, I'm just going to lead in by saying the remake's absolutely appalling. Yeah, it's really, really terrible. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I mean, I saw it last September. I was taken to see it for my birthday. and I didn't know we were going to do this today, so I haven't got any notes sort of fresh in my head. But I'm just going to make a few brief comparisons for you listening at home. So basically, one of my main problems is the character of Judah Ben-Hur himself. Obviously, played by Charlton Heston, is this sort of a tour de force of conflicted masculinity, featuring serving in a galley ship.
You truly are the King of Kings.
That's not from Ben-Hur.
Oh, is that Ten Commandments?
It's not from the Ten Commandments either. I don't know what that's from.
It's from The Simpsons. It's when he meets.
Yeah, well, it's from
Mr.
The Simpsons.
Burns.
It's not
Mr.
from.
Mr. Burns pretending to be Jesus.
Yeah, it's not from.
Which one does he meet Jesus in?
Yeah, that is Ben-Hur, but no.
Aha!
One, yeah, but no one says that in the film.
All right, but someone.
But it's
doing
in The
a
Simpsons.
Charlton,
okay, yeah.
Preston.
You truly
are.
Yeah. So the character of Ben-Hur is got to be a really strong character to carry the story. It's a really dynamic. It's a massive story. It's a massive sort of saga esque. I mean, at one point he becomes very high up in the Roman command. And goes going from being a galley slave. So Charlton Heston, obviously. He's got a lot of magnitude, that man. Whenever you see him on screen, you can't take your eyes off him, as far as I'm concerned. What's his face? Who did it in the remake? Can't even remember his name.
Jack Houston. What a hard name to forget.
Poor old Jack Houston. I mean, he's an Abercrombie and Fitch model, basically. That's how I see him, dead behind the eyes. There's just nothing that, he's completely forgettable. So that's the biggest problem. But my main problem with it, apart from all, the adding of the love story between the removal, I suppose, of the homoeroticism, which is a big thing in the first film.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that is the whole reason in my head that Masala turned vengeful, because he felt betrayed by the man he loved.
Oh, how was Toby Kebbell?
Better than Jack Houston.
Yeah.
But not by a lot. He's
actually the antagonist in the war. The second Planet of the Apes movies.
So, yeah, he's not terrible, but he's no Stephen Boyd.
He shows up in a lot of stuff, and he always it's always these clunkers, like Wrath of the Titans. He was in as second fiddle, and
he wasn't bad.
But the rest of it was shit.
Yeah, he's okay. More memorable, but the thing is, when you compare him to Stephen Boyd, the subtlety of Stephen Boyd, the curl of that lip, I mean, I'll never, that's a facial expression that stays in my head for as long as I live, just that little lip curl that he does. The removal of that whole relationship between Ben-Hur and Masala, I think, sets it off on the wrong foot straight away, because it makes Masala's turning on him quite shallow, and makes it sort of negates that whole the depth of that character in a way that I feel isn't fair to that character, and it also makes the rest of the story seem a bit weird. I just don't know why you'd go to that length, when the feeling isn't there.
Was it a CGI catastrophe as well?
Oh, everything was CGI. I'm gonna come to that in a minute.
Yeah,
I'm coming to that in a minute. So that's my first issue. Thinking about characters. My second issue, well, I don't know
Morgan
what number
Freeman.
I'm up to actually. Yeah, Morgan Freeman is coming right up.
Time period is this set?
So it's the time of Christ, so it's the birth of Christ, so 2,000 years ago.
2,000, actually, what do you call that then? Zero?
Zero BCE.
Ben-Hur
and Jesus are meant to have been born at the same time.
Right. Okay.
So they're the same age, basically. So it ends.
And Brian in a tent next to them.
Brian? Oh, what and Brian, Brian, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Brian on the crucifix next door. So Morgan Freeman is the character I want to come to next. In the 54, is it 54, 56? When's Ben-Hur made?
Oh, in the 50s.
In the 50s version of Ben-Hur, played by Hugh Griffiths, the Welsh actor Hugh Griffiths. And I think he won an Oscar for that, didn't he? Best Supporting Actor.
Really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he did.
Is this the guy that takes him under his wing?
Yeah, the Sheik.
Who he saves?
Who he saves?
On the ship, doesn't he?
That's the Roman centurion guy.
Right, okay,
that's a different
not
character.
What I'm thinking of.
No, you're thinking of the Sheik who owns the chariots, who owns the horses
Judah
Ben-Hur goes to race, race with in the circus. So the character of the Sheik, played by Hugh Griffiths in the 50s version, played by Morgan Freeman in the recent. What year was it?
2016.
Yeah, last year. The 2016 version.
Let's just say 60 years on.
Yeah, I mean, Hugh Griffiths is a brilliant comedy character. And again, like, you have to take it what it is. Okay, there's blacking up going on and we don't like that. But it was the 50s and things were different then. So again, that's a separate conversation. However, Morgan Freeman, brilliant actor, of course. We all love a bit of Morgan. But he destroys that character. He takes all the fun out of it. And actually, he says... He sort of becomes this sort of vanquishing, like, knight in shining armour, like, moralistic hero in the end. And, like, at the beginning, he's all sort of, oh, I'm just in it for me, I'm just in it for
what,
me.
What, like a Shakespeare third act kind of
Yeah,
figure?
Yeah, do you know what I mean? He's like, when
just
he first meets Judah,
goes,
he first meets Judah and he's really hostile and a bit sort of cagey and a bit, well, you can race my horses if you want, but only because it's going to benefit me, that sort of thing. Yeah, I'll save you, I won't kill you. But only because it's going to benefit me. And then suddenly he turns around and becomes this sort of godfather figure, this fairy godfather who just, I don't know, takes it, as you say, takes him under his wing and shows Judah Ben-Hur that it doesn't, he doesn't have to kill to be happy. And that's something that was explored, obviously, in the 50s film. But it's played out in the recent version in such a cheesy, over-sentimental way. It's just not realistic at all. And again... because the depth of feeling is not expressed earlier in the film between Messala and Ben-Hur, it just all seems really out of place and completely pointless. Like, fine, I get the whole vengeance thing. Like, Ben-Hur's served all this time on a galley ship. He wants vengeance. But, like, why would Messala care? Why would he risk his... I don't know. I just feel like it's really... The depth of character just makes it all seem like they're just going through the motions just for the sake of narrative. Narrative-wise... oh my god, the end of the film. I'm going to talk about the CGI first. I'm going to save the end for the end because it's just...
wow, we're going to be here all fucking day.
It is a Christmas cracker. I'm going to wrap up soon. I mean, if you told me we were going to do this, Stephen, I would have rewatched it and then I would have been here all day. But thank
well,
heavens that's not the case.
Well, I have no intention of rewatching it.
The CGI. I mean, you know what? Ben-Hur, if you're going to remake Ben-Hur, put some fucking effort in. I'm not joking. I mean, the CGI, the galley battle is just appalling. And I think I saw it in 3D because it was only showing in 3D.
Ugh.
And you think, you know, that could have been okay in 3D if that's what you want to do with it.
If it had been directed by someone other than the guy that did Abraham Lincoln,
yeah, exactly,
Vampire Hunter.
Exactly. He's an Italian director.
No, he's Russian. He did those
it.
Night Watch movies,
yeah,
Night Watch
it.
And Day Watch as well. Which
and I can tell he's got a sense of fun about him, this director. Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter being testament to that, but like
wanted,
but don't tackle something with this level of significance if you're kind of a bit more up for having a bit of fun with your film, because it's just going to be naffs, as is, you know, as evidenced by the chariot scenes in the galley scene, which are all CGI, and in the chariot scene, fine, there's a little bit of like probably some actual real horse riding.
I think at one point they had Tom Hiddleston attached as Judah.
Well,
Ben-Hur.
I'm glad he backed out because it would have been. You know, it would have been shameful for him. He's a good actor, that
and
man.
And to bring things full circle, he has recently just been in a monkey movie, the new Kong one.
Oh, okay. Oh, I might see.
Yeah,
that.
You'll like that, mate.
Yeah, I might see that.
Which also has Toby Kebbell in it.
Really interesting. But yeah, the CGI is appalling. The galley scene just leaves you cold, and it's just sort of relying on flaming cannons being thrown in your face in 3D, and that's all it's got. It's like, you know, it's like a cheap scare basically. It's like
anybody
the hand on
screams.
The shoulder. It turns out to be your best mate, and that sort of thing. Yeah, exactly. That's what it relies on, is the 3D throwing a cannonball in your face. And I'm just sort of after seeing the impacts of the live action 50s version, it just doesn't compare. The chariot scene as well. It drags a bit, that scene, if
it
I remember.
It drags?
Yeah, it drags because...
no pun intended.
Well, it does drag. And again, like again in the 50s version, they show the whole race. They don't cut any of it out.
That's
all however many laps. It's quite a lot of laps.
Right.
I can't remember how many.
what do you mean? They cut bits out, but it still drags.
No, they don't cut bits out. No,
no, no, the new
I'm
one.
Saying, I don't remember if they cut bits out, but it just feels really slow and boring.
How do they cut bits out? Just... they got like women walking around with cars for each round.
Well, no, but I'm sorry. They basically make it into like this really high action. Like high intensity, just like I don't know what they're trying to do with it, but they're vamping it up so much because they know the significance of the scene, but it's just all wrong. The focus is all wrong, the focal points are all wrong, and it just again leaves me cold. It's a disaster. The ending of the film is I mean, I'm just going to be brief here because there's not, I mean, it speaks for itself.
That's 15 minutes in.
So, look, come on, 15 minutes is a decent amount of time to spend on the best film ever. Right?
Oh, you've been not talking about that one.
Right, the ending of the film, as per the book by Lew Wallace, is the it's the death of Christ, basically. So the death of Christ happens, and then everyone is cured, and all the, you know, the biblical stuff happens, and all you see after that moment is Judah Ben-Hur being reunited with his mother and sister, who are now in full health, and Esther, sort of the woman he loves, and they just all hug. That's the end. Masala's dead. No mention. The Sheikh has gone back. You know, he's gone off with his caravan. Right, in the new film, I kid you not, this is how it ends. So, after the chariot race, when Masala gets sort of mauled a bit, right,
does a Flash Gordon jump into the camera?
Yeah, basically. I mean, might as well. Ben-Hur comes to see him, as he does in the 50s film, but instead of being like this cold, like ruthless, "You're dead now, mate." Yes. Instead of that, what we get in the new film is crying and, "I'm so sorry, let's be friends again." Literally, this is how pretty much how the conversation goes. "Please, can we be friends again?" "Oh, okay. Yeah, I won't steal your pencils anymore. Yeah, okay, fine. And I won't tell teacher on you anymore. Let's be friends again." Yeah, I mean, that's literally the level of the standard of the conversation is like that. So they agreed to be friends again, even though Masala's lost a leg.
Whoa, Masala's still alive?
Yeah. So Masala's, he stays alive, doesn't die, loses a leg.
What?
Yeah. And then in the end, this is the ending of the film, it's Ben-Hur, Masala, his sister, and the Sheikh galloping off into the sunset.
What, Indiana Jones style?
Yeah, what the actual fuck?
Masala's only got one leg and he's still galloping.
Well, no, he's got like a prosthetic leg thing, fine. But what, like,
God
what
bless
is...
all those engineers back in those days, huh?
Well, no, I'm sorry, you know, they're, I'm sure they would have been able to manufacture something of it. I mean, I don't think he could have walked on it.
Word with straps on it, right?
Yeah, basically, like a plinth sort of off. Thing, which would enable him to ride a horse, definitely. And presumably he's on crutches the rest of the time. No,
Jesus,
I mean, right...
takes one look at the stump because I can do something about that.
No, do you know what? I mean, I think given the extent of Roman medical science, I think probably that's a thing that could have been engineered.
Oh, I meant his carpentry skills.
Yeah, I mean, that's the least of my concerns, because I'm really much more concerned with Ben-Hur, the Sheikh, Masala, and Ben-Hur's sister galloping off into the Sumerian.
So we skip Jesus?
Yeah, Jesus isn't even in it. Well, he's in sort of reference.
Does he have that one scene when he fucking meets
the crucifixion,
him and gives
him water? Like, isn't in it?
No, then like halfway through and he gives him
some water. Yeah, I think
so
that's
you have
in
that.
It. But you see Jesus' face as well, which I kind of like. I'm not a person of religion.
CG Jesus' face?
You see Jesus, like he's actually there.
Oh, you
there.
See
he's a
Jesus.
Because in the 50s version, you never see his face.
Right.
And I like that. I mean, I'm not a person of religion. And even if I were, I'd be a person of the Jewish religion, so it's not really relevant, strictly. But I like the fact that you don't see Jesus' face, because it's an interesting character contrivance. It's sort of this like, again, like a fairy godmother figure who you never really know who they are. I mean, obviously you do know it's Jesus, but you can't place them. The fact, you know, and you can sort of imagine them being everywhere, a bit more everyman. The fact, when you see Jesus, and also I think he talks in it, which I don't really like either, because it just sort of... It removes that quite interesting, so that sort of character plot nuance of having this sort of... Anyway,
yeah.
So yeah, they all gallop. So Jesus isn't really a feature anyway. Jesus is like, yeah, whatever. We don't want religion anymore. It's 2016. We just want friendship. The removal of homoeroticism, and galloping off into the sunset with Morgan Freeman. Absolute bullshit.
So no one's died?
No, no one dies.
So we don't get like see someone in the clouds above them, like looking down next to, like, you know, Elvis and that alligator from
Happy
Gilmore.
No one dies. Masala and Ben-Hur just make friends again, and everyone is happily ever after.
Oh,
I mean,
dear.
Why would you do that?
So your rating for the original is still, I'm guessing, 5 out of 5.
If I could go more than 5,
but
I would.
You can't, can you, out of 5?
I'm going to give it a strong 13 out of 5 anyway.
And then the new one?
Oh, it's just, I mean, it's...
Would if we were still zero-starring stuff, would we be doing that to
yeah.
it? Is it that
yeah,
awful?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Nice down. Not even any funny moments in it.
Well, I wasn't planning on watching it anyway.
No, don't watch it.
Good. Well, good. Let's get off that, then.
Please, let's.
All right, then. So, we're going to move on to the meat. It's been fucking 20 minutes already of this show, where we're going to do our double bill. We're going to talk about the Sleuth movies.
Yes.
The original 1972. And then the 2008?
Seven.
Right. Remake by Kenneth Branagh. Both films featuring Michael Caine playing alternating roles. So the first film... So the play was written by Anthony Schaefer, and the first film stars... Sir Laurence Olivier and Michael Caine, and they are literally the only two people that we get in this movie. No one talks about it, so it's not even like out on Blu-ray or anything, so eventually as time goes on it's going to get its
that's
re-release.
That's really surprising.
It is, isn't it? Even despite the fact that it got a fucking remake. And
but it's had another remake
that
since
be, that
as
would
well.
Be the top. What, has it?
Yeah, in 2014 or something. There was apparently a really shitty one.
What, a film?
I don't know if it was a film or if it was like a TV film or whatever, but there was something.
Yeah. So, yeah, and then the remake. I mean, we might cross over a little bit with both of them, but we'll try and do one film then the other. We're going to focus on the first film and
yeah,
what's
I would,
great about
I would like,
it.
I would definitely like to do a little bit of comparative analysis.
Yes. Yeah, well, we definitely have to because... Yeah. I am much more sympathetic towards the remake than you are.
Yes, you probably are.
Yeah. But having said that, because at the time when I watched the remake, we'll get into it when we get there, so let's get on with it. So basically, for anyone that doesn't know, we are going to spoil this, but we're not going to retell the story, but just so you get the gist, it's an older gentleman invites a younger guy to his country house to discuss with him his wife, because the younger guy is now seeing the wife of the older married gentleman, and the older gentleman has sort of pulled him there on a ruse to get him to rob his place so that he can then claim insurance money, and so that the young guy can then keep the wife, because she's high maintenance apparently, so the older guy doesn't have to bother with her anymore. That all turns out to be a ruse in order to murder the young guy, which then also turns out to be a ruse. He's actually just there to scare the living shit out of him. It's complicated as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I was going to say,
It's a complete two-hander. It is loaded with dialogue, and it's basically the two of them playing, and this is just the opening act. The film essentially happens in three main acts. The first act is what I'm explaining now, the two of them meeting at this place and this thing going down, where the older gentleman gets the upper hand over the younger guy. The second act is the younger guy coming back disguised as a police officer and gets the upper hand on the older guy. And then the third act is...
Can we just use their names to make life easier for the people listening.
So the young guy is Milo Tyndall, played by Michael Caine. And what's the name of...
Andrew Wyke.
Andrew Wyke is the Laurence Olivier's character. And he is an author...
Of detective fiction.
Detective fiction. Absolutely. And is completely up his own arse and loves games.
Yes.
But it turns out they both like playing games. And they play many, many games on each other. Mm-hmm. Games is the big sort of overlaying theme throughout this film. And this first film in particular... displays that beautifully in a visual sense as well. I mean, the opening of the film, you have a playful tune playing in the background as Milo arrives in his car and has to find Andrew Wyke. Andrew Wyke is sitting in the middle of a maze out in his back garden. So right there, you've got gameplay already with this maze, and that you can't get to the centre of the maze. There's a trick door. And then inside his house, when we go inside there is automata everywhere. And games pretty much in every room. He even hides his safe behind a game, which is a dartboard. Yeah. So you first saw this one. Did I introduce you to this one?
Yeah, I saw it. We watched them both in the same sitting, I think.
I had seen the original a couple of times before. I hadn't seen it when I was young. I saw it when I was in London, I think, living in the first house, and so probably a couple of years before you saw it.
Yeah, so it was about five odd years ago that I first saw them, and to be honest, my view on both of them hasn't really changed that much. The first one I rate incredibly highly for reasons I'm sure I'm about to go into, and the remake is trash, frankly. But again, I'll come back to that later.
I've got my defence for the second film.
There are defending elements.
I think it's definitely at least worth watching. It's one of these films that you may not like it, but you will have gone, I can see why it was an interesting approach, maybe. But it
doesn't work. Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah.
But I mean, for, I mean, the first one is over 2 hours long. It's a long film, and the remake is 88 minutes.
Yeah,
it's really short, and it's because it's it pretty much executes that third act.
It completely cuts it out
and rewrites it in a way that's not necessarily satisfying.
And it also, in my view, and it's odd because it's a Pinter script.
I forgot to mention that. Harold Pinter did the adaptation, which I think makes it interesting, but again, people will go, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, because actually, all of the things that made the first film so beautiful are kind of shaved off, it seems like, for the sake of running time. I don't know why they felt such a need to get it under an hour and a half.
Because it's not like, it doesn't feel like it's going fast, the remake, either.
No, it drags.
Yeah, it's...
But we'll come to that.
Yeah. Oh, the remake, we should say, Michael Caine plays the character of Andrew Wyke in that case, and it is Jude Law, who comes in to play Milo Tyndall, which felt like the right choice at the time, because he had remade Alfie, so he was obviously a big Caine fan, and he also produced the film as well. And there's a nice little dialogue drop there when Andrew Wyke in the remake, when Michael Caine gets the upper hand over Jude Law says, "What's it all about?" Which is obviously the Alfie tagline, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't seen Alfie, you know.
There you go. If you look at the Jude Law poster, I think it says, "What's it all about?" on there, and he actually drops that line to Michael Caine in the Sleuth remake.
Oh, that's nice.
Things like that I picked up on. Yeah.
Let's get into the first film,
then. Yes.
So, I don't know, I mean, what do you want to talk about first, Stephen?
I was basically giving the layout of the land. It is literally games everywhere. And, I'm going to comparison straight away. When they, you know, they're very polite to each other and what have you, but in a sort of side jabbing kind of way. And again, the Pinter version, it's much more on the nose. So it's like when you talk about Milo's background, you know, is the name Hungarian? You know, are you a half breed and stuff like that? You know, the dialogue in the original is much, much more subtle than it is in the remake. And when it comes down to the business of, I understand you're sleeping with my wife.
I understand you're fucking my wife.
Exactly. That's what it becomes in the, remake. Yeah.
Big eye roll
like,
from
fucking
me.
Hell. Which doesn't work. But it also doesn't work because they've already talked about that in the remake.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't make any sense. The impact is completely gone.
Yeah. Whereas in the first one, they don't address...
They leave you in the dark about why Milo's actually come to see Andrew. Yeah. For a good few minutes, a good 10 or so
minutes. Yeah, they come in, they have a drink, and
they're
talking about
stuff. Or something,
and he's looking around and admiring the automata, and then they've got the clapping, laughing clown.
It's a sailor.
Yeah. Was it? Mm. Oh, no, he dresses up the crown. Oh, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, because I want to talk a little bit about...
I
want to
know what
the...
that game is on his table that he's playing.
What? Which
game? With the blocks on it.
That, you will see in... Speaking of Ben-Hur and Ten Commandments, you will see that game being played in the Ten Commandments. It's called Jackal and Hounds. That's what they call it in the Ten Commandments.
And Jackal and what?
Jackals and Hounds.
Okay.
You will see that being played in the Ten Commandments by the Pharaoh who's in power before.
Because Andrew goes, please put that back. It's taken me a long time to get it there. And I'm like, you've got four blocks on this board.
Yeah, the one with the pointy things that sort of stick up, the little...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Jackal's and Hounds in the Ten Commandments.
Fucked up looking
anyway,
version of chess.
I suppose it probably is, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing that I do want to at some point, I don't know if we're going to spend some time talking about the aesthetic, I'm sure we are, but I wanted to talk about the themes. Yeah, the aesthetics of the film.
What a broad word to use.
The way the film looks is important. I also want to spend some time going into a bit more detail about the choice of props and set, I suppose, in the older film, and I think there's quite significant allegorical inferences being made there that are just again completely redundant and not there in the remake. But one thing, I mean, you've already touched on it a bit, Stephen, but the thing that I find the most disappointing about the remake is the lack of subtlety and the lack of and it's all about wit. The original really is about wit. It's about a twinkle in the eye, and it's about cleverness. It's inferring the meaning from what you're not saying. That's kind of what it's about. And in the remake, that's just not there because it's fuck this, cunt that. And like, okay, fine. But the first film, really, the dialogue is lyrical. It's beautiful. It's lovely to listen to. And obviously, you've got Laurence Olivier delivering it anyway. I mean, Michael Caine, I like Michael Caine as a person. I don't rate him as an actor. He's not a terribly good actor. But he has a lovely presence on screen. And for him, I think the role of Milo Tindallini is the perfect role, because he is a jumped-up pantry boy who doesn't know his place. And I think that's kind of...
Smiths. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. But I feel like that's kind of... That role is kind of Michael Caine playing Michael Caine. So I think it works.
Every little scene that they have together in the beginning, though, you can see the tension building in that very, mm-hmm. very playful way as they're still getting to know each other. Because even when Andrew takes him into the room, this is Laurence Olivier, and starts playing his game of pool that he's already halfway through. Snooker, should I say. Mm-hmm. And... Milo just assumes that they're going to be playing together, so he picks up a cue and watches as the guy pops one ball after the other after the other, and he finishes his game before Milo has even had a chance to have a shot, and he says to him, yeah. "What are you doing with that cue in your hand?" And he's like, "Oh, sorry, I was under the assumption that I was going to be..."
And it's interesting that whilst they're playing that game of pool, they're having a conversation about Andrew's sexual prowess.
Yes.
And Andrew's saying that he's an Olympian in the sack. And there's this lovely sort of little bit about where Milo says, "I suppose you go in for the sprints rather than the marathons these days." And it's just interesting again the sort of the symbolism of Andrew using the cue, very phallic shape, to sort of pot all these holes as he's showing off about his sexual prowess, and that's all gone from the second one as well. The conversation's still there, but it's just floating, hanging in the air.
You get very, very little foul language in the first one. I think "bastard" is the word that comes out. And again, that's saved to the third act when he's running around losing his temper, going "bastard."
And it's again a lot of that's because it's I think it is a script of its time. So and it would have been, I mean, you do have, I suppose. I mean, foul language was in existence in the 70s, but I just don't think it's necessary, and I think, as I say, it detracts from the lyricism of the dialogue, which is Andrew Schaefer wrote it. Is that what you said?
Anthony
Schaefer. I mean, I don't know what else he wrote, but he's an absolute, he's a modern day Shakespeare. Yeah. Frankly, I'll throw it out there. It's brilliant.
No, absolutely, it is a terrific script. Every act has several scenes in it, mm-hmm. and each scene is leading to something, and each scene is very, very playful. But they've directed it and staged it in such a way that the actors really get to show off the way they look and the way they move with each other as well.
So I think now is a good time for me to bring in.
Which you don't get in a sequel with Michael Caine running around in a fucking dressing gown for half the movie.
Yeah, I know. What's that about? Anyway, I would like to bring in one of the major things that occurred to me on rewatching the first film, and then again rewatching the second film. So this is sort of the note of allegory that you get in the film. So obviously this was written in 1972. It's post-war. It's a time sort of in the early 70s when it was a bit of a time, I suppose, of transition away from in sort of in the country. I mean, in Great Britain, in England, whatever, away from the austerity, the post-war austerity, and B the final admission that the empire's good and gone, and that sort of the dying off of that generation.
Despite
into
everything goes being played throughout.
that's there. into this sort of generation of the uppie, the second generation migrants, yes. like Milo Tindall, who haven't really experienced necessarily. They haven't experienced Empire Britain. They didn't. They may have lived through the war, but they were probably very young. And
yeah, well, they're really more 50s, 60s,
exactly.
Growing up,
And are now sort of on the up in with this sort of the very early sort of signifier that the early signifier of the uppie, who of course in the 80s was everywhere.
Again,
now,
a very well cast Michael Caine.
Exactly,
he was a 60s
exactly,
icon.
Exactly, yeah. and that's one reason why I think it is kind of Michael Caine playing Michael Caine. But not, I don't mean that disparaging. I just think that's what it is. Now, one thing I want to talk about is the fact that I kind of see this film as a really beautifully sculpted sort of representation of the conflict, the sort of the internal conflict in society between these two changing changing attitudes, I suppose. You have, on the one hand, Andrew Wyke, who at the beginning when he says about putting his detective stories on the television, he's so disparaging towards it. Oh, I wouldn't allow them to do it, because the idea of anything being on television is cheapening. It's the entertainment for the masses, and it's sort of, you know, it's populist and it's not elitist. Whereas, of course, in the second film, it opens with Michael Caine with Andrew watching a televised version of one of his books. So that's an interesting difference, which I suppose is Pinter, I suppose, trying to continue the allegory but make it relevant to 2007. So there's sort of, and this is where I want to talk about all the toys that Andrew has in his house. I kind of see them as symbols of the Empire. The sailor, especially, who's the main one that keeps getting referred back to, is just that. I mean, he's now a toy. He has no function. He's defunct. He just sort of laughs inanely. And there's that bit when,
and is controlled.
Yeah, and exactly, and is sort of only kept alive by Andrew pressing this button. And that's what Andrew is. He is a relic of a bygone era. Who's keeping it alive with all these games and all these sort of these attitudes, which are completely irrelevant now. And there's that moment when, like, what's the detective called?
Inspector Doppler.
Doppler. When Doppler comes in, and he's sort of poking around all these toys, and Andrew goes, "They all still work." And Doppler goes, "Yeah, I don't suppose they'd be much good if they didn't." And that for me is quite a poignant line, because that is the sort of this metaphor sums up of these things are all toys. They have no function anymore. They're defunct. They're useless. They're not much good anymore. And that's kind of a really interesting reading for me of this film, which is completely not there in the second film. And I think without that layer,
How long did it take you to figure out that it was Michael Caine in disguise?
It did. I was fooled by it for quite a long time.
For a little while, I was like, hang on a minute.
Hang on a minute about it.
Because I wasn't expecting anything
exactly.
like that.
Exactly. And because you really do think...
So I'm guessing back then it probably fooled a lot more people, because they were more into getting fooled by makeup and stuff. Perhaps.
I don't know. I wouldn't like to say. Let's ask Chris Hick, who's all of 45. I don't know. I just think that's a really interesting way of reading film, which I didn't necessarily see the first time around, but now I do see, and I think it really detracts from the remake through that not being there. And again, there are hints of it. It's kind of the reason it's been updated is to sort of continue that allegory into the 21st century, but I just don't think it doesn't have any weight to it. And it's relying on you watching the first one and continuing it in your own head rather than
the Doppler thing, because he doesn't use Doppler in the...
No, he's called something else.
Something else. And I think that's because it's so much more modern set that it wouldn't work. Whereas with the Andrew Wyke, the one's Olivier of the generation you were talking about, it does work because his intellect, he feels, is so high, and he plays a game on such a high level that he completely misses this obvious joke in front of him, a really base joke. You know, Doppler becomes Plodder, PC Plod.
And Doppelganger.
Yeah,
well.
And exactly. And that's what he was fooled by, you know. By a character that he looks down on in real life. You know, his policemen are much, much more of the Sherlock Holmes.
Well, again, this
ilk.
This is it. This is the allegory continued. It's the refusal of this older generation to sort of, and not all of them, obviously, but there was very much a resistance to embracing post-Empire Britain, and with all its technology and with all its... It's more sort of... I don't know what I'm trying to say, but it's less about grandeur and it's more about functionality, I suppose.
Yeah. But the Doppler, a.k.a. Milo in disguise, sets it up beautifully, and it's the funniest moment. And when I rewatched it, I laughed the loudest at this moment. And it's basically the giveaway of him pretending that this police person is a bit of an idiot or not, and the way that Andrew responds to him. And it's when he helps himself to his caviar. And he goes, "Caviar, wonderful, you know, I've never tried this before." And then he eats it and he goes, "I don't fancy it myself, tastes like fish eggs." And Andrew just gives him that sort of cold stare and just goes, "Fancy."
Yes.
Because he's really playing into what he actually thinks policemen actually are in real life, which are, you know, dumbasses.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's made clear throughout the whole thing that Andrew, or the first one at least, that Andrew has no time for the actual police.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's why it's so nice to see him really reduced to being 10 inches tall by PC plod. he's a very, you know, he's the way that Doppler presents himself is there's no fuss, there's no pomp. It is just, I'm a detective, I'm going to look for clues.
So the whole Doppler sequence, that's the second act of the first movie. Yeah, the first act, like we said, is Andrew setting up Milo to rob his house and then turns it against him and threatens to murder him. And
yeah, so I want to talk a bit more.
Do we need to talk about Joey?
Who's Joey?
The clown.
Oh, Joey the clown, yeah. Yeah, I would like to talk about that. If nothing else, just to sort of comment on why it's not used or anything like it is used in the second in the remake. Mm. So in the film, when they're staging this elaborate sham burglary of these jewels.
Yes. Milo's going to steal the jewels from Andrew. Andrew will claim the insurance, and then Milo will use the money from them to a fence, which he can then use to support Andrew's ex-wife. Yep. Yeah.
So Andrew is very insistent that this has got to be a real crime of the imagination.
Yes,
is I think what he says it is at one point. They must have an elaborate disguise. You can't break in dressed as yourself. You've got to have the disguise. So they go into the fancy dress box, into the cellar. There's this spooky cellar with the skeleton in the closet.
Ooh. That's right. Yeah.
And
the coal.
The what? Oh, the coal. Well, yeah, the coal's later.
And all the little theatre things as well.
Yes, yeah. All the theatre, the sort of the toy stage representations of Andrew's plays,
drama,
which
drama
have really stupid names.
You call them.
Milo ends up being dressed as a clown, which again is a fairly obvious.
Yeah.
It's a fairly obvious jibe, but
it's probably the most on the nose thing in this film.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's got the big floppy
big
shoes.
Floppy feet, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He's got the whole works, and it's just nice watching him sort of run up. It's a funny moment. Yeah, watching him running about with this giant ladder and trying to climb up a ladder, and the ladder sinks into the ground. It's quite Charlie Chaplin. It's very nice. And again, I feel that I'm just going to keep going with my allegory here because I think it does work. That to me is how Andrew sees this younger generation, this younger probably migrant generation of upcoming
yeah,
professionals.
Talk about,
I suppose,
the fact that he is of Italian descent, and they, although the name was originally Tindallini, mine was last name, he's changed it to Tindall.
Mm.
Yeah.
And he's just viewed as an absolute clown by Andrew, who is a relic of the Empire, and that whole time and that whole attitude towards the sort of the people that Milo represents. But of course, the clown quickly turns himself. Well, I mean, yeah, he's executed. He's executed on the staircase,
That's
isn't he?
Right.
So as part of this,
puts the gun to the back of his head, tells him he's going to kill him.
Yeah. So as part of this ruse, where Andrew says, "Well, of course, I have to discover you stealing the jewels. We have to have a fight. It has to be realistic." And then I pull a gun on you. Or he probably says it in a lot better words than that. And Milo still thinks this is part of the game. Yeah, very funny. Very funny, Andrew. Yeah, you pull a gun on me.
Because he shoots a couple of things.
Yes, so Andrew fires two shots, real life shots,
and one of them goes into the picture where his wife is in.
Yeah, picture of him and Marguerite. And one of them goes.
Marguerite becomes Maggie.
And one of them goes into a vase or something. I can't remember.
And then he
puts a gun to Milo's head. Milo is, of course, he's crying and pleading for his life, and he's a sorry state.
This is where he calls him a jumped up pantry boy.
You're a jumped up pantry boy who doesn't
know his
place. Because
I might go
and
kill you. Yep.
And pulls the trigger. End of Act 1.
Yes. So Act 2 is when Doppler comes in, and it's basically Michael Caine in disguise, and he's there to investigate the disappearance of Milo.
Who apparently hasn't been seen since he got shot.
Yes. If you haven't seen, if you don't see right through the makeup, then you are fooled into thinking, oh, he did kill him. Because all you see is Michael Caine fall to the bottom of the stairs and then that's it. Cut to more bloody Cole Porter or whatever it is back in playing. And all the automata going off, little lady playing on her piano. I love that one. The little monkey one on the bars and stuff. And so on and so forth. But, you know, as it turns out, he basically scared the shit out of him and sent him on his way. As this police officer, he's drawing it out to that Milo has not been heard from since, and he's engineered it in such a way that he's going to make Andrew think that he's now wanted for the murder.
Now, Andrew knows full well, because
of course
he was there.
Yeah.
He knows that Milo wasn't dead and that Milo did leave the house with his tail between his legs.
Yep.
But we as the audience do not know that.
Yeah.
Until we find out that Doppler is Milo.
Yeah.
So there's that wonderful ambiguity of did he actually kill him or not?
Because he's come back and he's planted evidence like blood and stuff like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. He's planted his old clothes
and
in the wardrobe.
And it's wonderful just watching Laurence Olivier lose his cool, completely lose it, and up to the point of when he then reveals himself as Milo. And it's an even better bit after that is when you see Andrew straight away try and get his call back. Oh, I knew it was a joke.
I knew all along, yes. You let yourself go a little bit towards the end.
And I think that's where you really start to see the proper person.
Yeah.
You know, this complete fucking
scoundrel, scumbag.
That can't take a joke, can't take his own medicine.
He'll only play a game when he's winning.
Exactly. And always has to be the one in charge. He cannot deal with being not in control of the situation, which leads to what happens at the end of the third act.
Yeah, so...
Totally. He is completely humiliated by the end of the
film.
Well,
let's save that, because I think... Okay. Let's talk about Act 2 of the remake.
Okay, a couple of things about the remake. The remake, let's put this one in context then. It's completely modern set. It's the same premise. It's just the two of them again. It's a much shorter film. But, and as we've already mentioned, the dialogue is much, much more severe. And like I said, I've actually got the line down here, what he says. He says, you know, I've come here to talk about Maggie. She wants a divorce. And then it's literally minutes after that, they sit down with each other. And then Michael Caine says, so I understand you're fucking my wife.
No, and we're know that.
We know this already.
Yeah, that
if you had opened with that line, I might go, oh, this one's going to be much more harsh and blah, blah, blah. But it was a redundant line anyway.
Yeah, it was
so
completely
redundant.
So
that's two reasons why it doesn't work. Now, his place is unbelievably minimalistic. There are no games everywhere. It's got all this blue lighting, like you're going inside a fucking disco or something.
Yeah, it's all... the atmosphere changes with the lighting, or the lighting changes with the atmosphere. It's got all these coloured lights, and you can change at the push of a button. Everything's button controlled.
There is a soundtrack that plays throughout, which is the old violin or fucking cello playing or whatever.
It's very Steve Reich. Is that him?
Right.
I can't remember his name. Anyway, it's very him.
But there are still things that, I mean, you can see that Branagh is done all these things deliberately. I mean, obviously they've deliberately picked a script that is going to be harsh in its language and on the nose. They've deliberately gotten rid of all this because they didn't want to do an actual note for note remake of the original by having this beautiful mansion with all these props. They've stripped all that out. They've basically taken everything that you can use visually in that first film and said we want to do something completely different. So in that sense, the film bears merit
for trying
to be something completely different in the way that it looks. And you can see Branagh is working really hard with the angles that he's choosing and with the choices that they've made in the staging. I mean, he's even got the drink ready for Milo already.
Yeah, I kind of agree to a point. I mean...
Oh, don't get me wrong. I know that it doesn't work.
No. I'm not... It's not that. I mean, I agree that it doesn't work. The thing that I obviously they are trying to do something that looks completely different. But I think Branagh, and because, you know, credit to Branagh, I mean, we all know Branagh's he's a fantastic craftsman. Everything he touches really ought to be of top quality. So it's a shame this one hasn't worked. But I feel that I can see what he's tried to do. He's tried to take sort of the subtlety of the this metaphor running throughout the first film and update it for the 21st century. So instead of having all these old empire relics, he's got all this modern technology.
Yeah.
And it's like Andrew is now this character who's not clinging on to the past. He's trying to cling on to the future to keep himself in the future. I'm still with it. Yeah. I'm still here. I still exist. I'm still important. And that is an important message, I think, for the 21st century, is this sort of the people who are sort of Andrew's age at the turn of the century, when things are progressing so quickly and us are being kind of left behind to an extent. I mean, like, the number of older people today who still don't even have a computer or access to the internet and stuff because they've been left behind. So I feel like that is an important message, and it's sort of a mirror image, if you like, of the Andrew in the 70s version. The reason why it doesn't work for me is because, A, Michael Caine is obviously from... He's obviously a working class person. He doesn't even put on a voice or anything.
Yeah.
And that kind of, again, I can sort of kind of say, fine, he's nouveau riche, he's made his money doing whatever.
Yeah.
But him like being this sort of Alan Sugar, I suppose. Do you know what I mean? Like this sort of coming from nothing and making all your money. You wouldn't necessarily.
I think that's
you wouldn't necessarily feel that insecure about your place in the world if that's who you are. And a lot of what the story, the narrative tries to create is Andrew is this character who is very insecure about his place in the world and is desperately looking for something to latch onto to keep him in the present and in
I think
future.
That's why they completely drop the Doppler thing, because you don't hear him go on about having idiot policemen in his books, because you know that his version of Andrew wouldn't think that way about them. But he is still dumb enough to fall, well, dumb enough, he still falls for the policeman act, but it's not the dumb policeman act.
Which
is why I think they got rid of the whole talk about the content of his books. He talks about doing thrillers, but they don't talk about the content of them.
No, and yeah, again, it's probably because
you wouldn't buy it. This guy with that accent, with that type of an accent, you know, has come from working class, so therefore wouldn't write characters in
that way.
Well,
and also, this is the age of CSI. Everyone loves the police. Everyone's very embracing of police technology. And in order to write a bestseller, I mean, people read Sherlock Holmes because it's archetypal of a time, a bygone era, but people don't want to read modern stuff about today, set today, that's in that vein, because it's not a current way of thinking.
How do you feel that Michael Caine and Jude Law work together?
I get the
sense
that
there's a lot of stilted. I think the thing that bothers me, sorry to cut you off straight away, is, and I don't think either of them are bad, I think they didn't massage the scenes enough. There's a lot of, in the dialogue in particular, because there's a lot of someone saying something and the other one replying, do you? Does it? Do they? Are they? You know, there's a lot of that in a provocative kind of way, especially from Law's character. Michael Caine might say something like, something about Maggie, and he'll go, does she? And give him a hard glare.
It's a very telling, does she?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Oh, does she really?
There's way too much of the... asking a short your answer is a short question done in a provocative kind of way, and it gets annoying.
It does, and again, I feel that is a similar. Remember, a few minutes ago, I said that in the first film, it's the meaning behind what's not said that's kind of important in the dialogue, and I feel like that's again a sort of much in the second film. That's a much snappier way of trying to communicate the same thing. Maggie says this about you. Does she? Yeah, okay, we get it. It feels quite laboured, and I agree, like, it's not massaged enough. That's a really nice way of putting it. But I feel like, I mean, you can tell Michael Caine and Jude Law, they must be great friends offset.
I bet they fucking loved doing
I do get that from watching them on screen together. But to me, I mean, Jude Law is the eternal brat, and he kind of always plays a brat, really, in a lot of things. I mean, you think of him in...
Townsend, Mitchell, Ripley.
Yeah, and The Talented Mr. Ripley in the Oscar Wilde film.
He was fucking good in The Talented Mr.
Ripley.
Yeah,
he's good, but he's always a brat. And I think a lot of that is because, you know, that's what he's good at, fine. But I just don't feel... I don't feel threatened by his imagination. Like, I just feel like he's a brat. A very clever, manipulative...
I get the impression he's much more of a con artist in the second one. You don't actually think that he's going to hang... with the wife. By the end of the film, you think we'll talk about the end of the film when we get to the end, because that's I'll go off on way too big a tangent. Alright, well, I'll mention some things that I said I'm much more forgiving of the second one. On the latest rewatch, because when I first watched it, I was into it, the idea of it being different, and I watched it a few times to soak it up, and then I'd been away from it for a few years, and then watched both of them again for this podcast, and then I really didn't get on with the remake. There's still things about it that I like, though. And the comedy highlight for me in the second one is I love the fact that they tie to the first film, because he says he's an actor, and Michael Caine's character says, "I thought I heard you were a hairdresser," which is what Milo was in the original film. And I love the fact that that keeps getting drawn out, especially when he's got the gun pulled on him, and he's like, "You think I'd let my wife away to someone who like this, someone like that, and a hairdresser like you?" And he's like, "I'm not a fucking hairdresser."
But then in the end, he's saying,
"I am a hairdresser." And you're just like, "Hey," and that's what I'm going on about the third act being slightly confusing. He suddenly becomes something very different.
We'll get to the third act later. Let's not, because it's worth.
In terms of what he wants,
But I just feel.
How'd you feel about his policeman?
It's kind of a carbon copy. It's trying to be a carbon copy of Doppler.
Yeah,
it's not
kind
it's,
of, but,
it gets more. Yeah. He does get
and he's,
more.
He's putting on this West Country accent.
Yeah,
And but when I first saw it, I was like, "Who does he look like?" He looks like someone from a bloody Britpop band. One of these like ancient ones with that this sort of grizzled look. He's got all the stubble and stuff.
And all that
like a bloody Happy Mondays reject
what's
or something
it called,
the hair
that synthetic skin the latex skin I Doppler I feel is kind of a carbon copy of the first Doppler, except that he gets more aggressive at the end. I mean
Block or Black, I think he was called,
can't remember,
Inspector Block or Inspector Black, it was one or the other, it might be Block.
So in the first film, when it's getting towards the climax of the second act, if you like, Doppler does get quite aggressively accusatory.
Absolutely.
And he grabs him, he puts him in an arm lock and so on, he forces him up. So it does get quite physical, and that happens in the second one as well. It's more, I think it goes a bit far, I feel, in the second one. Like, if a policeman suddenly started doing that, especially, it rises quite quickly as well from being conversational and this is what
to being
I think
on, yeah,
to
yeah,
being
yeah.
punching him in the
yeah.
stomach
throwing
and
him in the
throwing
elevator
him yeah exactly it does it rises very quickly and I think that's a bit silly, but other than that, yeah, basically a carbon copy. But I kind of like the relationship between Andrew and the policeman Block is not there in the second one, because you haven't had that build up in the first act of what Andrew thinks about the police. So it's kind of, it only works in the first film, the original film, it works on many levels, that whole act, because you've got if you just take it on its basic sort of face value level, you've got a policeman interrogating Andrew and Andrew being in the shit about this game that he played. But you've also then got Andrew grappling with his own feelings towards the police, and then suddenly having to relinquish his own power and his own superiority over the police force as he realizes that he's being put in a hole that he's being trumped, I suppose. In the second film, in the remake, you don't have those levels. You just have the one level of Andrew being. Landed in a big pile of shit by the police force, but it doesn't have that deeper meaning. It doesn't have that deeper sympathy, if you like, for Andrew as someone who feels quite strongly that he's superior to the police force anyway. So it's quite facile and.
Yeah. So going on to the third acts of both films, the first one is because it's much longer. The third act, a good 40 minutes,
and it's brilliant. It flies by. It's punchy. It's like
it's
bang,
brilliant
bang,
because
bang.
You've had those first two acts of each of them getting the upper hand
and quite
over the other
slow
one.
Slow game playing in the first,
and
two
the third
acts.
One is like now the fucking game is on, but they both are aware of it,
and they're both reveling in it in their own way.
In their own way, but again, Milo has the upper hand because he says
to Andrew, he's running the game.
Yeah, he's running the game. He essentially says to him, "Right, okay, so you frightened me to the point where I thought I was going to die. I basically frightened you to the point where you thought you were going to get arrested. So you still have the upper hand, Andrew. So for this final last game, you and I, we are going to talk about death. And to start it off, I have murdered someone, mm-hmm. and it's he says he's murdered Andrew's
mistress.
Taya. Oh God, poor Taya.
Well, that's the line. We'll come back to that line.
And he's basically planted pieces of evidence in plain sight that Andrew can find, because he has also called the police and they're going to be here in 10, 15 minutes, whatever it is. So the countdown is on and the game is on, and you're basically racing around with Michael Caine with his glass in his hand, very quietly giving out clues, singing bits of tune or whatever, or giving little bits of lyrical poem for him to discover these things. And he does, he gets them one at a time.
He does find all the clues.
And it's beautiful. I mean, in the end, it leads to it's all a ruse again. He hasn't murdered anyone, the police aren't really there. And you see, that's when you get the horrid look of defeat on Andrew White's face. And then Michael Caine's like, right, I'm out of here.
Just to recap.
Backtrack, go on.
Tyndall, Milo says he's murdered Taya. The police are coming at 10 o'clock. It's 9:45 now. There are 5 clues in plain sight. You've got to find them. And we really see, these clues are cryptic clues. They're cryptic crossword clues.
Yes.
I'm sure they don't conform to the actual rules of cryptic crosswords, but there are cryptic clues, and you really see all of the inner workings of Andrew's mind. And you do see, actually, they're probably the two men are very much on a par with each other, because Andrew, as you said, gets all the clues, and the working out process is quite fantastic to watch. It's like watching a Sherlock Holmes sort of thing. It's this deduction is just absolutely incredible, and the way that his mind goes in even into things he doesn't know about, that he's able to deduce through things that he kind of half knows about that are related to it. The Anything Goes one, I think, is probably the best one. I mean, it's not that clever. Like, it's not that clever when you know what it is, but it's just lovely watching it get to that point. So we get to the end of these 5 clues, and Andrew is genuinely reveling in this game. The reason he's playing is because he believes that the police are coming at 10 o'clock.
Yes.
And that, he's going to be implicated in this murder. But despite that, I mean, he loves it. When 10 o'clock is coming, and he's found all the clues, and he hears the policeman, in inverted commas, outside having a conversation
with Milo. Because he's cleaned himself up again.
He sits down and reads his paper. There's this look of real triumph. He's like, yes, I've done it.
Yeah, and he's like, come in, officer.
Milo comes in, and it turns out it was just him having a conversation with himself, putting on a funny voice. There are no police there at all.
Yeah.
That, for me, that's the turning point. When Andrew has his victory taken away from him, that's what turns him. It's not the fact that he's been beaten. It's the fact that he had that victory, and that was a great victory. And I think before I knew that it wasn't, that the police weren't really there, I was like, fucking ace, Andrew, you've done it. That was fantastic. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, you're kind of... I was quite behind him. I mean, I feel equal disdain and sympathy for both characters, but I was really supportive of Andrew, like, beating the clock on that one. And when he has that victory torn away from him, I think that's the final humiliation, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he then pulls a gun again.
Well, because Milo says, you know, I am off, and Marguerite is not coming home. He's going to go get her coat, and then he's off. But he can't have that. And basically, he shoots Milo, but Milo has already.
So this is
This is what makes to me Milo an absolute genius.
Yeah.
Is because despite this final game, and it's
a game within
utterly
a game.
Cruel act that he's committed. For some reason, he has foreseen that Andrew would go too far himself. They've both gone too far, basically. So they both deserve to, and they both essentially lose. But again, they've also both sort of got one over the other in the wrong sense. Milo has pushed Andrew to the point of defeat where he can't live. He can't, you know, have someone else.
It's the ultimate humiliation.
Yeah, the ultimate humiliation. And Milo has his life taken.
So this is what happens. Milo is all set. Right, I'm taking Marguerite's fur coat. Off I go. By the way, Andrew, just in case you try anything funny, I have actually called the police, and they really are going to be here any minute now. Yeah, right, mate, heard it all before. Or are they? Who really knows at this point? So Milo is skipping merrily out the door, leaving Andrew in this sort of state of dismay, and he's a broken man. That's brilliant.
Does he tell him that he's actually called the
police?
Yeah,
he does.
Okay.
He does.
I just wasn't sure if...
What's that, Andrew? I can hear something up the path, Andrew. Did you hear that whole moment where he's...
He was faking them arriving.
No, but he does it again, I think. Maybe he doesn't. No, I'm
pretty sure that you just hear them arriving and then it's like, oh, fuck, he did call them.
Oh, okay, maybe. Maybe I'm getting confused.
Yeah. Because then Andrew's like, oh, fuck, because, you know, the sound and the sirens, and he's just going to hide. And then Milo, in his last moment...
His dying breath.
Gets hold of the sailor clown,
the remote control
remote,
for all
and turns
of the
it on to make the yeah to make the laughing and the noise go, so the police know someone's inside. And he says, you know, something to them. Just tell them it was all a bloody game.
Yeah, and then he dies laughing.
Yes, Michael Caine gets to say bloody something.
Yeah, yeah. So that's how it ends. It ends with Milo actually being shot, but with his final action is game over to Andrew. Game over to Milo. You're getting nicked for murder.
Yeah,
I'm dead. or am I? Ooh.
Yeah.
I bet he's
it's
not
so
really
good.
Dead.
No, nah, he's
not.
Dead. Because he falls over after he sets off.
Yeah, I know he falls over, but I've fallen over and I'm not dead.
Well, that's hardly the fucking point, isn't it? And apparently, especially with plays, I had this argument with, we were doing an Ibsen play, I think it was Ghosts, which Kenneth Branagh did on TV. So there we go.
A little
bit of a join there. And people like Judy Dench and Freddie Jones, I think. It was in the liner notes of the book I had. Can't remember what the play is. But in the end, the Branagh character, who's the son, just descends into dementia or something. And I was and we were talking about the play, and I asked the stupid thing of, but after, this could happen. And the teacher completely struck me down and said, you can't do that. Because it doesn't exist.
No, I know. Yeah, it's true.
So you can't talk about...
No, I know you can't,
you can talk about well, maybe whatever, but in terms of the actual construct of the thing itself, you can't talk
about
before or
after. It's all about syphilis anyway,
Ghost.
Did you know?
I think that's right,
yeah,
yes.
It's all about syphilis. So it's a syphilis-related psychosis.
Lovely.
There we go. No syphilis in Sleuth, though, so,
so
that's fine.
So that's that one, and it's brilliant, and it's wonderful, and not, you know, there's... are there any moments in the original where you're like, oh, this is dragging?
Never, not one moment. And it's a long, it's not a long film, but it's not a short film.
It's 2 hours and 35 minutes, I think.
It's not quite that long. It's 2 hours and 12, I think.
What, 3 minutes shorter than what I just said?
You said 35. I said 12.
What did I say? 2 hours and 35?
Yeah, I said 2 hours and 12.
Oh, I meant 135 minutes.
Oh, yes. Right.
Sorry.
So it's not a short film, but it's not a long film, but no, for 2 hours. And it's quite neat as well. As you said, it's three... I mean, it is a play, so it probably would have been a three-act play on the stage.
And that's the only two people you see.
And those, yeah, it's a lovely sort of one room almost, you know what I mean? It's one set. It's a brilliant thing. It's beautifully crafted. It's beautifully constructed. It doesn't drag at any point. I really can't fault it on any level.
So the third act of the remake, you don't get that game at all.
Oh, it's just dreadful.
It's basically, but it does have it has the same point of, oh, so that's 1-1. And it's like, no. Milo is like, no, you're still ahead because you frightened me to death. All I did was humiliate you, make you think you're going to get arrested. So it continues. The third act does go into Milo continuing the torture, and this is where I'm like, oh my god, I can't watch this. Because Michael Caine is running around in his bloody bathrobe still, and he gets him to wear the jewellery and stuff, so he's still got him at gunpoint.
It's just cringy.
And it's cringeworthy, and it's like, what's going on? What on earth is all this nonsense about? And it really does lose any sort of point of where it's going. But then, and I'll say, although it doesn't work again, but to its credit, they try something new where they try to really knock the homoeroticism on the nose. With the relationship between these two.
Yeah, and I think in a way
that it drives towards the end where Andrew Wyke is inviting Milo to stay with him. Yeah.
So
this is where I get confused about what Milo wants, because I don't know what Milo wants in reality, because I'm like, does he want... Because at the end, he says, by the way, that was Maggie on the phone, she's coming back to you, baby, you know. She loves your money, baby. Mm. She's coming back, which turns out to be true because she arrives at the house at the very end.
But that makes no sense.
I know.
With the conversations that he's supposedly had on the phone. I don't really know.
I know. So that's why I'm a bit like, what has gone on here? And also you've got... But Andrew is saying, I don't care, I don't want her back. But he wants him to stay with him. And I find that interesting, but they didn't delve into it in a very interesting way.
No,
and
it
does have
it
that.
It wasn't interesting.
But I have to give, you know, points to Law for the way that he repels him in disgust at the very end, because you've even got him, you know, trying to stroke him at one point, and he just leaps up and starts. This is where the, you know, the language really gets hit on the bloody nose, because he's effing and swearing at him.
No, they've already been called cunts in the
and
first act.
No, have they?
Yeah.
Have they? All right. Because he goes, and one more thing, you're a cunt.
Yeah, they've already said that in the first act, so again,
maybe it was the way they framed it. I was like, whoa. And then he just grabs a coat that he thinks, so I'm going to wear this.
It's the leather coat that, again, in the first act, Andrew points out, that coat alone is worth £5,000. Can you afford £5,000, Milo? You'd better steal the jewels, so you can. Yeah, so the third act, it's very strange. So there's sort of this weird stalemate moment where, yeah, after that bizarre Andrew putting the jewellery on at gunpoint. And that's a moment that I find particularly strange. So here's what's going on. Jude Law, what's his face, Milo, he's still got the gun.
Yeah.
And he's still holding it on Andrew. Mm-hmm. And even though, like, the second game is over, it's been revealed that it wasn't a plea. But he's still holding the gun on Andrew. And he one point, yeah, he goes, put the jewellery on. And there's this, and then it cuts to, like, Michael Caine just looking a bit pathetic.
Yeah.
Although I think, actually, the earrings really do suit him. I'm just throwing that out there. I think they look very nice on him. Anyway, so that happens. And Michael Caine is, Andrew is suddenly... this quivering wreck. Oh, this is so embarrassing. Mm. But then suddenly the tension in the scene really changes very abruptly with no justification. So it goes from Andrew being, I'm humiliated, I'm afraid, I'm not very happy, and then suddenly he just says, actually, do you know what, Milo, I don't think these earrings really suit me, I'm going to take them off.
Yeah.
And again, like, why? I don't really see how a character could go from, I think I'm about to be shot, to,
yeah,
okay, we're playing a game again now. Like, that for me, that was very jarring, and I felt...
Jude Law kept, far too many times, kept, you know, turning at the fucking jerk again. No, it was all just a game, see?
He becomes
very manic in that last third act.
Yeah, and it's not good. Anyway, I'm still going.
Go on.
So that's one... That for me...
Talking, yeah.
Exactly. That, for me, sets up the abrupt sort of the jarringness... Mm. Of the third act is this, these sudden changes in tension and in dynamic that don't appear to have, they don't make any sense in the narrative, and they don't make any sense with with, like, the actual characters playing them out either. So that happens, and then there's this stalemate again. It's like that game's over. Andrew's taken off the jewellery. Jude Law's having a drink.
You to pour me a drink. I liked that moment.
Yeah, so we're getting to that
because of the long pause that Michael Caine takes.
Oh yeah, can I just take a moment on the subject of long pauses? There are two times in the film where you have just the camera on Michael Caine's face for about 30 seconds, it feels like.
Yeah.
And I know those are meant to be really, like, deep moments where...
Well, that was
but
one
they're
of
just
them which
not, they're just, no, I just don't... I just feel like Michael Caine is not... Bless him, he's not a good enough actor to be able to convey that.
The last one, when he's lying on the bed when Law's about to leave... That's unconvincing. He looks like he's asleep.
Yeah, exactly.
Bored,
he's just blank.
And bored of,
he's
of doing another take.
He's very blank. And that's because I think, as I say, I like Michael Caine a lot. He's very good at what he does, but he's not good at what he can't do.
The problem is he doesn't have...
That level of acting is not within his capability.
For me, I couldn't read any sex appeal for the homoerotic sense of it.
No, he's not
it,
sexy.
Because
he's not played sexy.
Because who would look at that and think that was sexy?
No, I don't think you can say that.
I did just say that.
Yeah, but I don't agree with that at all. Because that in itself is not where the sex appeal lies. It's in the money, it's in the status, it's in the wealth, it's in the cleverness,
exactly.
It's in the imagination.
So having him standing there in his fucking bathrobe in the last third act doesn't
help. It's not... It doesn't help, but...
Whereas the first act, at least he was in his fucking suit.
Yeah, but I feel like...
Because he's saying that. He's saying, I've got wealth and money, and we can travel anywhere and you want. We can do anything you want.
But that, I think, again, like that, the fact that he's in his dressing gown, for me, is part of the point that I was making earlier about how...
Is that why he's repelled?
Is about... No, it's not why he's repelled. It's the point I'm making about Andrew in this updated version being this sort
British
of fading...
imperialist, yeah.
No, he's not an imperialist anymore. Imperialism's gone from this version. It's all about this older man trying to cling on to the current generation and cling on to the future and cling on to the present even. And when you see him in his dressing gown, it's kind of a bit like, you're just a bit pathetic, mate. Sorry, you're not even wearing a shirt. Do you know what I mean? It's that poignancy of him being a doddery old man ultimately. And I don't know that I like. I mean, I haven't really thought that through enough to be able to say how I feel about that. But it doesn't sit that well with me, and I don't. Anyway, yeah, so what am I talking about? I'm talking about the third act. So yeah, they're at stalemate, and then suddenly Andrew says, I've got a proposition for you, and this is where it really veers off from the original.
Yes.
I'm not going to go through it again, because you've just said it. So the proposition is, come and live with me. I don't really understand why Andrew would say that. I mean, I can understand why he'd think that, because obviously he is obviously very excited by somebody who can play games at a level that he plays games. I get that. What I don't get then is a man whose whole life apparently is about pressing buttons and playing games and playing little tricks on people and pressing a button and that changes over there and you don't know how it happened because the button was hidden. But why that person would then expose themselves to that level of vulnerability at that moment, because that does not make sense to me.
Because that's what he does. He basically
opens himself completely up
and says, come in.
And that is not something that character... I mean, in fact, that to me is the definitive contradiction of what that character would do, because the real, if the character is as it's trying to be, this sort of so aloof from reality, so intent on living life as a game, and then simultaneously so excited by coming across someone who is the same, who's trying to do that as well. The last thing that person would do is end the game. They would keep that game going for as long as is humanly possible. So that for me is where the character just completely falls flat on its face and stops having any credibility, and is just then reduced to this sort of, as I say, quite unsympathetic, I feel, this quite unsympathetic portrayal of the sort of the pathetic older man trying to cling on to this young upstart.
Yeah.
And I don't think I like that very much, frankly.
No, well, in that case, you're not surprised that Milo's like, hell no, in the end.
Exactly, but I'm also
wondering, what the hell is Milo doing? Why is he dragging this on for so long?
Because he's just toying with him. That's what I mean, he's just being a brat.
And that's where the cleverness goes away.
He's had
more than one victory at this point, so it's because we're missing that third game. It's like, why are you hanging around here? Why are you still talking
pathetic.
To him?
You've
embarrassed
pathetic.
Him twice, you've made him wear his own fucking wife's jewellery, and... why are you still here talking?
Yeah.
And then there's the phone call with the Maggie thing, and then that's when, you know, eventually he's like, she's coming back, I'm out of here. But because Wyke feels so pathetic at that point, that's when he, again, Milo gets shot. And then... but he doesn't say, oh, I don't believe she's not coming back. He thinks, right, she is coming back, and then that's where it ends with the doorbell ringing.
Well, he might or he might not, whatever.
So, again, it ends with the doorbell ring, so he's going to be done for murder of Milo. But it's nothing compared to the way that the first one ended.
And the thing is, Milo, in the third act, because of the improbability, I suppose, or the... Of the way that Andrew behaves, Milo stops being clever in the third act. There is nothing clever about what he does. He's just being a brat. And that moment that you touched on a few minutes ago about pour me a drink, Andrew.
Yeah.
There's nothing clever there. That is just barefaced manipulation. That's just emotional manipulation.
Yeah.
That is preying on this pathetic character who's so desperate for affection and validation. I mean, it's cruel. It's not clever. It's just cruel.
It's the time, though, when I thought, oh, if they did live together, is this what it would be like? Would it be the young one flaunting around, doing what he likes, tormenting the older person? And would it be the older person playing his games?
No, because the games have stopped
and
by this
is,
point.
No. If they became a couple that lived and travelled together.
Yeah, but it would be a very abusive couple.
What would the dynamic be? And that's where my mind was... getting interested of what would happen here, and that was a key indicator of that, because that's where it was going to start, with him saying, you get me a drink.
Well, clearly,
and Kane is initially going, you can get your own drink, and that long pause before he does then get him a drink.
Clearly it would be a very abusive, enabling relationship. Which is, again, I just think,
but then it doesn't develop it beyond
it's just, and then Milo's all over the place. Yes, this sounds like a lovely idea. Yes, I'll give you a cuddle. Blah blah blah. I don't know. Like then the homoeroticism.
And then suddenly you get your hand off me.
Yeah. And then suddenly you get your hand off me. And again, I get that. Like, okay, he's playing him along. It's meant to be the final humiliation. But the humiliation of yeah, all right, then I'll come and live with you, compared to the humiliation in the first film, they're not comparable, frankly. I mean, the first one was really Andrew had his core stripped from him, because for him, he's a game man. He will enter the game, he will play the game as long as it is a game. Mm. But when he has that stripped, when he has that taken away from him, the fact that when he has the victory taken away from him, his whole reason for existing is taken away from him.
Yeah.
Whereas in the second film, all that it really is just sort of a, you know, it's not that much more than, like, you know, you go back to someone's house after a night out, and then in the morning they're like, oh, actually, I think you should go now. Do you know what I mean? It's that. Like, it's like, oh, it's, you know, obviously it's a bit more than that because, you know, the things I've already said about the character that Andrew becomes. It's not profound, it's not sophisticated, it's not intelligent, it's not imaginative,
And the weird thing is that third act really drags, and as we've already mentioned, it's the film's 88 minutes. You know, it's over half an hour shorter than the original.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, for those that are interested, because I definitely think people who love the first one should definitely check out the second one, just out of curiosity.
Yeah, definitely.
To see how different it looks and certain plays, because it's something you could watch and talk about afterwards with other people.
Mm.
And, you know, you can be talking about what's wrong with it, mainly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting enough. But if you get the DVD or the Blu-ray, because I had the DVD, there are two commentary tracks on there. One Jude Law does by himself, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
But Branagh and Kane do another one together, and it's exceptional because they spend a lot of time talking about the original.
Well, that's good.
As well, yeah. And they're talking about it, and so they defend a lot of the choices that they make on there, so it's a very interesting watch. But you hear a lot of stories from Kane about Laurence Olivier and what went on set
lovely.
And stuff. So you'll probably find that more interesting to watch than the film itself.
Stephen, do you remember...
You've got the bloody disc, so you can listen to that yourself.
Do you remember that time when I called out the actor in that Dorian Gray film?
It's funny you say that, because I was... What was it that I just... Oh, I was on Netflix and I saw they have Dorian Gray there. And
what's
I was like,
name?
Hey, there's Ben Barnes. Danny bitched out at an Empire thing.
So once upon a time, I was at Empire MovieCon.
Hmm? Yep. He was on Westworld recently.
Oh, okay. And I called out Ben Barnes for the atrocious remake of Dorian Gray, where I said, okay, hats off to you for attempting it, but why on earth would you make the artistic and narrative choices that you made, which obviously are not as good as the originals? And Ben Barnes had this sort of quite...
He wasn't expecting to get asked that, because everyone's
why
like,
not?
Oh,
that's
I love you
an obvious question.
Yeah, so you
such
actually asked
question.
A critical question, which,
yeah, and
which
his,
you never get at
and
these
his
events.
Response was along the lines of, well, you know, we just sort of thought we wanted to make it relevant to a modern audience, blah, 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 blah. And that, I mean, I haven't listened to this commentary.
And then he ended with a sort of, I take it you didn't like it then.
Yeah, I was like, no, I did
and
not
got
like
half
it.
A laugh.
That, for me, is
I
what's...
then had to turn to Danny and say, you know, he didn't write and direct the fucking adaptation.
I don't
he
care.
Just starred
in it. Yeah, but that's, do you know what I mean? Like, he's a pretty important part of the production. Anyway, that for me is like if I could see Jude Law and Michael Caine in a panel, I'd ask them the same question: like, why did you feel the need to adapt something that is still as relevant now as it was when it was made?
So that's what's the author? Wilde, right?
Oscar, yeah.
An Ideal Husband, I think, was done around about a similar time.
I don't know.
Give or take a few years. That was the same director, because he's obviously an Oscar Wilde fan, Oliver Parker.
Well, and I bet it was dreadful too.
He also did the two St. Trinians movies.
Dreadful.
He did something else quite recently that was a fairly sort of big-ish hit, I think. I can't remember the hell what it was for the life of me. But he started off as an actor. He was tiny little roles in fucking Hellraiser and shit. If you've ever seen Nightbreed, he's the main monster before the tentacles come out the back of his head that bites the hero.
Okay, well, that's
immediately what I think of when I think of that director.
Like,
oh, I'll tell you what he did, and we'll bring the circle around to Branagh again. He directed Kenneth Branagh in Othello with Lawrence Fishburne, where Kenneth Branagh played a fucking amazing Iago.
Yeah, that's a good film.
Yeah.
So that's weird. Like, it's weird how sometimes these people... I mean, even Kenneth Branagh, as I say, I'm pinned
to... Go on, mention some other film and I'll bring it back to some writer
or director. No. Anyway, the point I was making was that I'm reminded of that moment where I watched the Dorian Gray remake and then asked Ben Barnes that question, because to me it's the same thing. Why have you done this? I see what you've tried to do. I understand what you've tried to do. I understand why it hasn't worked. But what I can't for the life of me understand is why you've done it in the first place, other than it's a passion project.
Yes.
And it would be quite... You know, there's a lot of nice little in-jokes you could have for the lols.
Oh, I can bring this full circle.
So that's my,
which is finished talking.
That is my that's my sort of resounding afterthought after watching the remake of Sleuth. I understand it. I can see, if I think about it critically, I can see all the justifications that you're probably going to tell me for all the decisions you've made, but I still can't see for the life of me why you've done it.
Yes.
And that's sort of where I'm left.
Right, and to bring that full circle, you mentioned it was the Empire live event, and it was the Empire live event where we saw the footage for Outlander, which Jack Houston was there on site wearing a beanie on his head, and I went, oh great, another fucking Orlando Bloom Johnny Depp wannabe.
Well, I don't remember that, but then I don't remember Jack Houston anyway.
I'm wondering if it was actually the year before when I went with my friend Jess instead, where the Outlander stuff was on.
No, because I was there when Jess was there. But maybe that was the second year.
No, not the first year. That's when I went with Jess the first year.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So.
Well, anyway.
Maybe. Anyway.
That's
so,
that.
Yeah. But, all right, to wrap it up then. So, right, well, I mean, I'd give the first one 5, easily.
Yeah.
And I'm still going to give the second one 3.
2.
Oh, I'm surprised it got that much out.
Yeah, I was going to say 2 now, is a good 2 because it's a sunny day.
The last question I'm going to ask you, and my answer is yes, definitely. In 15 to 20 years' time, do you want them to do another one, and do you want Jude Law as Andrew Wyke?
Gosh, well, we'll see what state the world's in 15 to 20 years, but not really.
I just like the idea of that. Come on, let's pass it down
to
generations.
For the lols, like, we'll do it for a laugh, for a giggle, but
for
don't.
The lols.
That's the only reason I can think of, because the first one, it you know, for me to bring it full circle, it's like the Ben-Hur thing.
You could have that on
if
the poster
some,
today.
For the lols.
For the lols.
Yeah, exactly.
For the laughs, for the games.
But that's what I mean. Like, this is the thing. Like, if you've got something that perfect, that wonderfully sculpted and crafted, why would you then turn it into a shitty little, I don't know, second runner? I mean, why would you do it? I'd watch it if Jude Law is going to be Andrew Wyke when he's a little bit older. I'd watch it. I'd go, look, there's an in-joke.
Because it'd be interesting to see what young actor of the day who's up and coming
wants
to take that challenge.
I mean, it'll be fine. Like, there's another in-joke.
And you keep the material alive.
It's already alive. You know what? Put Sleuth on Blu-ray, re-release it in the cinemas.
Exactly.
It'll get a second wind. It's a brilliant film. I'm surprised it isn't in the cinema, actually, coming... I mean, not in the cinema, on the stage.
I'm surprised
they haven't brought it back.
Probably because the film didn't fucking help, did it? Because it didn't do well and
no,
it got bad.
No, but you think
reviews.
It's been long enough that I'm surprised it hasn't
been
on recently.
It's been a decade now since that one. So, it will come back. But, damn right I'd want to see something like that. And I would go and see that.
I would 100% go and see it on stage.
You get a couple of actors' names, young and an older one. You go, oh, I bet they're amazing together.
Yeah, I mean, get Patrick Stewart or someone like that in it. Do you know what I mean? Get a real quality actor in there.
Yeah.
I'd be well up for that. But I think I'd like to see it done on the stage again soon. And I think it's only a matter of time. I thought I'll do it. I'll bring it back. So there we go. I'll do that.
Excellent. Don't get Patrick Stewart. That's too obvious of a choice. Or Ian McKellen.
No, not Ian McKellen.
Anthony Hopkins. Actually, Hopkins would
do something different. Yeah, he'd be good.
McKellen and Stewart would do something too close to Olivier, I reckon.
Do you think? Yeah, I suppose they're all of a similar role.
They would play that kind of version of the character. Mm-hmm. Whereas Hopkins, you get something... Have you seen Westworld? Speaking of Ben Barnes...
have I? I can't remember.
No, you haven't then.
What do you think?
10-part TV show and Hopkins
is really
good in that.
Question?
Yes?
Female cast. What do you think?
Of that?
Yeah.
So swap the gender roles out.
Yeah, I'd be well up for that.
Yeah. Well,
because I think it would change.
You would have to completely rewrite that.
Well, you'd have to completely rewrite it anyway.
But, no, in the way that they toy with each other. But I don't want it done in a modern Joanna Lumley fucking and someone else kind of way. You'd have to be very careful how you write those scenes.
Well, not to make it gimmicky.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
Which is what tends to happen when you get the here's the female version or something.
Yeah, exactly.
It becomes
it's a gimmick. It's a here's the female version. And I don't think
I wouldn't want a version where it's too catty.
No, that's what I mean. I don't want it. I mean, if it's going to happen, it's not. It's not so that it can conform to stereotypes and gender expectations. It's so that it can add a new
dynamic.
But
the moment that they do that, they'll also transplant it to like an American thing, so it would be two American women.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. That'll be a shame.
In order to get it done right, you have to rename it, recast it, redo the roles, and rename it and have it done in fucking Norway or something with subtitles.
Yeah, yeah.
And then people go, oh wow, it's actually Sleuth that they did.
Yeah, just, yeah, I mean, I'd be up for something like that because that, I feel, would actually be adding something new to the discussion.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I'm not up for just
but
another remake.
I'd be very interested to have the acts sort of remain, especially that third act, because I want to know how they talk about men. Because we haven't really focused too much upon that, of the way that they speak about women in both versions. I'd love to see how, in a gender swap role, how they would then talk about who's, you know, the husband.
Yeah, yeah,
kind
yeah.
Kind of thing. Because that's why you have to really be, I mean, do you have a husband who's high maintenance that someone else is trying to support? Does that work?
Of course it does.
Because a lot of people go, oh, that's not, you know, common or whatever, but it's
yeah,
like,
and
good.
Those
you
people
need
are
to,
living in the 18th century.
If you write it well
century.
Enough, well, exactly, you have to write it well enough so that people, you know, accept it.
Well, yeah, you have to write it well enough so people accept it on every front, and that's no exception. But I'd be up for that. So
yeah.
If you're listening, anyone of note in the film industry, that's what we'd like to see.
I'd like to see both, if
both.
You don't mind,
right.
Because why settle for one when you can have both? It's like with any Shakespeare, if you can keep redoing Hamlet and keep sticking it in any time period, then why not do Sleuth in any
because
way,
nobody's
way.
Tried to rewrite Hamlet and make apart from The Lion King, it was a success, but you know,
fucking hate The Lion King.
Anyway, that's all I've got to say.
Anyway, well, that was good. That was one of our longest, easily we've gone, you know, a good hour and a half with that beginning bit as well. So thank you, Danny, for coming back one last time.
It's okay.
That was fun. Talk about films that we could actually you've actually watched.
Yeah, it always helps.
So I hope you enjoyed your time on Filmwork when you were doing it on more of a regular basis.
Oh, I did.
I hope you've enjoyed this one, but sadly that's it. I've got, like, you know, a couple of more shows to go and we're out of here.
Bye.